I don't typically order appetizers, but when somebody else orders them for the table or whatever, I love it. It's great. But man, the anxiety of when there is one too few or one too many, when it's just like, just barely, it's like, oh, I would love to have that extra taquito, but I'm not going to be the one that goes in and just grabs it when there's four of us and five taquitos and like, you know, like, I'm hungry. I just got appetized. Like I'm hungry now. So I want that extra one. And, or when there's one too few and it's like, okay, let's cut them all into two thirds so we can like somebody gets a third of each piece. Brendan breaks the silence around the refuge retreat. Mark was naughty on stage at Cambridge. And why the hell is food so hard? It's episode 22 of Convergence, The Silent Retreat.
How was the silent retreat?
Oh my God, dude. Okay, long story short.
Long story long.
Okay. I was just going to, like, the highlight is...
Okay, sure.
The first thing I did when I got back was look up a 10-day retreat.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Wow, indeed. Just fucking great, dude. Oh, my God. It was so good.
Walk me through it, man. Walk me through it.
Okay. So it was put on by Refuge Recovery, which is an addiction recovery system. It's like 12 steps, but using Buddhism as the path in. And it's honestly, it's more like Buddhism light than it is like AA. There's the structure.
So less Buddha heavy than AA is God heavy.
Yeah, there's really like in a regular meeting, there isn't really much talk of Buddha at all, actually. But like the structure of the way Buddhism enlightens you, the way that the path forward to enlightenment is the same path forward to a recovery from addiction, which is the same path forward to, you know, everything is everything that we've discussed so often. Whew. God, it was so great. I was expecting a little bit more silence, like dedicated time, because it was a 3-day retreat. And I knew it wasn't going to start immediately, but it started later than I thought and it kind of ended earlier than I thought. And so it was really just...
In terms of the bit where you were supposed to be quiet.
Exactly, yeah. It started at 7 p.m. and ended at 9 a.m. So it was really just, it was like a little over 30 hours or whatever. It was like one solid day in the middle and then a wing on each other end. And honestly, like it was, you know, a great introduction to doing a silent retreat. It was baby steps. It was pretty nice in that way.
That's probably sensible because, it might be a bit weird to be flung straight into it.
I mean, yeah, from what I've heard, the people that tried the 10-day retreats, like around day 3 or 4, they're starting to go nuts and they want to bolt and it's hard. And I kind of felt from my experience, like, man, I'm down for that challenge. That sounds really great.
Can I ask?
Please.
I don't know, pragmatic question. But I'm curious, if you accidentally, like if you forget.
Oh yeah, I forgot a few times.
Yeah, what happens?
Oh, absolutely nothing. It's like, it's just the intention is to be quiet. Yeah. So I didn't speak to any other people, but like while I was doing my walking meditations, in my head, I'm repeating my mantra. And sometimes I just say my mantra out loud and it was like, oh, nope. Yeah. Or there was one time when I was doing some yoga in between meditations and I was kind of in a funny pose looking the other direction, and on the path behind me, a local woman was walking her dog and two goats, and the dog came right up behind me. I had no idea and barked super loud and I was like, oh, hello. Yeah. And so, and then also there were 3 Dharma talks and I think there were 3 guided meditations. So our instructor or guide would tell us, you know, guide us through the meditation. And then afterwards, there was a Q&A for each of those things. And so there were points for people to be able to talk kind of throughout. But the intention is when not in those moments, you are in your own bubble, in your own zone, you're doing your own thing, doing whatever you want to do for that meditation. You're not making eye contact. You're not waving or smiling at people. You're not holding the door open for people even. And like, you don't slam it on them, but you just you just walk through and you're just you and you're not worried about anybody else. This led to something I had never felt before, which was so wonderful. So I've been to a bunch of different conferences and events and whatever, and gatherings of people. I've said this before, I'm an introvert, and I get, you know, built up from being alone, and I expend my energy from being around other people. I love other people. I love interacting, but it's just tiresome. And so I, like, as I'm going through the retreat, I know that for me, I'm just taking care of myself. And I know everybody else is also just taking care of themselves. And so I'm at this point where we just finished a sitting meditation, and we're all getting up to go out to go do a walking meditation. And I'm like looking down and getting my stuff together, getting my hat on and my glasses ready and whatever, take a drink of water. And I realize I don't have this little bit of low-level anxiety that somebody might walk up to me and just say hi, or hey, nice hat, or where are you going to walk? I'm thinking about going over here. Just like, you know, even a nice thing. And like, I'm never expecting like somebody to be a dick, but like just the mode shift that would have to happen from me being in my world to being in their world, our world, you know? And it's that relief was so palpable. I was just like, and then from then on, I was really able to bask in that feeling of just like, nobody's going to talk to me. I can just be. And what a relief. Oh, that just felt so good. And I love it when people come up to me and say hi, like, especially as an introvert, I'm not going to go say hi to them. So, and also as a nine, like, I don't want to disturb their peace, but like also having the option of being around other people, doing a joint effort and not having that was just superb. It was so great. I made one, it felt like a mistake shortly after I made it, but then I realized it wasn't really a mistake later on, I guess. Spoilers. So one of the pillars of both Buddhism and refuge recovery is to be of service, do acts of service, be of part of the community, the Sangha. And when there was a point where Noah, our fearless leader, called out for volunteers. He did this a few times, for volunteers for different types of things, like moving the chairs around or ringing the bells whenever there was a shift from sitting meditation to walking meditation to sitting meditation, etc. One of the first things he asked for were 10 volunteers to be table captains in the lunchroom. So those people would set up all the place settings, get the food delivered from the kitchen to the table, clean up the food from the table and wipe the table down. And I was like, oh, great. I love food. You know, I'm happy to help with that. Like, that's, you know, that's my jam. And then I realized in order to do, so the part of that volunteer is to be in the cafeteria 10 minutes before each meal. And so then I had to have my phone on me because I needed either a clock or an alarm or something, because the chime that everybody else hears is going to be at dinner time or at breakfast. It's not going to be 10 minutes before. So I was a little bit like, oh no, I have to have my phone on me the whole time. God damn it. But I wasn't tempted at all to use it for things like communication or, you know, scrolling or whatever stuff. I turned on airplane mode. I turned off the Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and stuff. And so it was like, it wasn't that big of a deal. And I turned the volume all the way down and just had it vibrate me when the alarm went off. And so it was very subtle and nice even. So it became a great thing. And then I really liked being a table captain. It was a fun, like, that was a meditation of itself. It's like setting each, you know, putting the plate, putting the fork, putting the knife, putting the spoon, putting the napkin, putting the cup for each setting. And then I was in charge of just one table every time. And I would have mostly the same people come to that table each time. And that was really great to kind of like, our first sit together for dinner on the first day was before the silence. And so we all got to kind of talk and get to know each other just a little bit, which was nice. And we got to, you know, share names and backgrounds a little bit and all this. And that was nice. And then we got into silence and we kind of stuck around with the same people. And so you can kind of, you feel their energy and you feel like this camaraderie and stuff, but you're also just focusing on yourself. You take one bite, you put your fork down, you chew it 30 times, you swallow, you feel the sensation of that. You bring your fork up, you smell it, you get all the sensation, you know, you take a slow drink, you know, like, and they give you an hour for each meal and they expect you to kind of take it and not rush through your meal. And yeah. Oh yeah.
So what was the mistake?
Oh, having my phone on, volunteering for something to have my phone on me. Cause when I was going into it, I was thinking like complete disconnection, you know, like no reliance on anything. I just want to be guided and not make an effort and just be like, all right, they're corralling me to do this thing now. And they're chiming me to do that thing now. And instead I had to do some management. I was like, all right, I got to set my alarm for, okay, 10 minutes before, what time is it? Dinner, or forget breakfast at that time. And it was just a little bit more managey than I was thinking. And that was my feeling of regret at first, but that passed after like the first meal. I was like, oh, this is great. This is great.
Mm-hmm. What do the days consist of? Or what did your sort of the main day consist of?
So you'd start at 7 with a waking up meditation. So the guidance for that was, when you woke up, was that on your in-breath or your out-breath?
How would you...
Uh-huh. You're trying to immediately get into the zone where you're just thinking about your breath. You're thinking Goodness about being me. Centered. You're being mindful of your body, your placement, everything. You're not like feeling groggy, you're not thinking about chores, you're not thinking about obligations or whatever. You're just like, okay, I'm awake, I'm here, what am I doing, what am I being, how am I acting? So that, and you're supposed to do that for about a half an hour. Then you do a sitting, so we'd gather in the main hall for a sitting meditation for about a half an hour. And then we would eat breakfast, and that would be for an hour. Usually people finish breakfast between a half an hour and 45 minutes. And then people would kind of either take a little bit of, like if there was a muffin or a thing that was kind of handheld, they'd take it outside and kind of eat the last little bit while watching the sunrise, or do some stretching or, you know, whatever else before we go into the main hall at 9 for the guided meditation with instructions and the Q&A. And that was really nice. It was cool to hear other people's questions. I actually appreciated the Q&A quite a bit. I didn't ever ask any questions. I was pretty happy to like try and do the silence as much as possible. But it was really cool to hear other people's questions. Then we would do a walking meditation. During after the meditation and with the instructions in Q&A, he gave us guidance on what to do for the walking meditation. So the guidance was to find a stretch of about 20 paces and you just walk straight in a straight line and then turn around and walk back. And you just turn around and walk forward and turn around and walk back. And you just keep on that one lane for about 45 minutes. And they gave a few different mantras, suggestions. There was a heavy guidance on forgiveness as kind of the theme of the day. The one that he gave, I remembered and was able to use and write down was, and you're thinking about this as you're stepping, you're taking your left, right. And you say, I forgive you. May you forgive me. I forgive myself. And you just keep repeating that over and over as you're walking. I would usually use that one as I'm walking to and from my meditation spot. I would sometimes use it in my meditation spot, but there was a couple places that I really liked on the property, this Minutia Retreat Center, that it was a beautiful spot. It's overlooking the Columbia River and in the gorge of Portland area. And it's a beautiful spot. It's kind of up on a cliff and lots of trees around, some birds, and they had a nice meadow. They had like a labyrinth. They had some walking trails. They have my little spot I really liked was kind of down a trail a little bit. And there was a little grassy spot that was about 23 paces long. And so it was like just big enough. And they had like a bench in the middle and it was overlooking a really nice spot of the river and stuff. So I usually went up there. But when I got to my spot, when I would do my meditations, what I would typically do is in my head as I'm walking forward, I would think foot, step, turn around, foot, step, and continue on with that. Sometimes I would do left, right, left, right, left, stop, turn around. And while that's going on, while I'm concentrating on the left and the right and the left and the right, and he gives some interesting guidance on this, and then I actually talked with my therapist about this later. He remarked on the bilateral stimulation of walking, which is the core property of EMDR therapy, of moving your eyes back and forth in bilateral stimulation to activate your brainstem where traumas are stored and located. And this left and right back and forth stimulation is like very similar to that. So that's why walking can be so therapeutic, is because you're just naturally doing that. You're naturally going back and forth, and it's kind of giving you this, yeah, it's a bilateral stimulation. I talked with my EMDR therapist, and she was like, yeah, actually, the woman that created EMDR realized it on a walk. She's like, why is this walk so good? And then did like a bunch of research and then like kind of created this therapy around it. I was like, oh, wow, this is the origins. Cool. A few major cool things happened. As I was doing that mantra going back and forth, I would think about other things also while I'm like, my monkey brain is like, yeah, sure, you can say foot, step in your head all you want. I'm also going to be thinking about things in between, even between the t and the s, there's thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I would think a lot about my parents, myself, a little bit about my sister and my ex-wife, and he who shall not be named, and other things like that. I even, at one point, I modified the forgiveness mantra to be, I forgive you, Mom. I forgive you, Dad. I forgive you, Jessica. I forgive you, Sarah. I forgive you, Guy. I forgive myself.
Turn around.
And then that would be enough to get to one side, and I would turn around and do the same thing again, go back and forth, just saying that over and over again. Sometimes I would do it backwards, and it was a palpable feeling of, I like that word today, of relief, of true forgiveness, of true like acceptance. So that was really great. I actually, during one of my meditations, walking meditations, I thought about this episode and was thinking about doing the footsteps and talking to you about it and how I want to edit it. I'm excited that I have the editing control now, and I can put together a little thing because I think it's going to be kind of fun. I had a couple great revelations on my first walking meditation. My brain went to, all right, what am I supposed to be doing? How can I do this better, or the best way? How most efficient, most effective, you know, and that kind of thing. And
how can I win this retreat?
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, all I need to do is actually just be here. I just need to exist. Yeah. I don't need to do anything. Mm. And so then I started to analyze, why did I want to do it better? Why do I also want to make, like with the Divergence episode, why do I want to help other people make their lives better? Why do I want this? Why do I have such a push and drive? Even though people keep telling me, like, you know, I'm putting too much effort into that kind of stuff and to focus on myself and, you know, like I'm trying too hard, whatever. I came to the realization, which, you know, realizations, whenever you tell somebody else about it, it just always feels so obvious or whatever. Even you think about it a little bit later, it's like, yeah, I kind of already knew that, but I didn't put it in these words or have this kind of feeling about it.
I think that's why maybe we call them revelations, because they were revealed to us. You know, they're always there, and then they get revealed.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. So it occurred to me that I want to help people grow, to be better people, because I wanted to improve my parents so that they could have been better parents for me, that they could have been less neglectful, that they could have been more responsible, that they could have been more present, that they could have guided me better and taught me more and been more a part of my life. So then I was left wanting so much and felt like, oh, I need to do something to get other people to kick into gear and do something to do what I want. So then I sat with that, or I walked with that for a while, and I was able to find acceptance and relief for, okay, yeah, my parents were the way they are. They had the pluses and minuses of everything that they were able to provide. There's no changing that. They're just who they are. Plus, it already happened. It's in the past. And I can accept that. I am now here where I am. And I'm here where I am in a place where I want to improve people's lives. I want to make things better. And I can accept that too. It doesn't have to be a bad thing, just like what they did doesn't have to be a bad thing. It can just be what it is. And there do need to be change agents in the world. There do need to be people that are pushing things to be better, or else if everybody was just complacent, nothing would ever grow and improve.
There is a question or a thought that occurs to me, which is, I guess it's wondering if you're so that ... has changed. Because if I think about your initial question or your initial task, it seemed very conscious of not putting words in your mouth, especially words that don't belong there. But it has the appearance to me of you saying, if I can fix these other people's lives, then there is some repair that I can make for the damage that was done to mine. Mm.
That's a great question. It's not really how I feel.
And that's what I'm pointing to, because that's what it sounded like the beginning of the journey, and then it sounds like maybe there's been a change.
Mm.
But it sounded like there's an open loop there. The way you put it initially was this, you know, my mum and dad haven't, you know, I didn't receive certain foundational pieces of care or you know, those fundamentals weren't there. It felt like, to me, I was wondering if you were trying to close that loop with the work that you were doing.
Yeah.
When the difficult thing is sometimes those loops don't close, for and sure. That's part of the difficulty.
Yeah, for sure. Not really. I don't really, like, I get that, and it's like, that's almost like a, sure, bonus if that would be the case, but that's not, not like at all like a goal.
Well, because you can't attain that.
I mean, yeah. Yes, for sure.
And that's kind of what I'm getting to. You know, you can feel better about that and you can feel more at peace with it, but you can't change the fact that, there were things that you needed that weren't there.
Yeah, of course. And there's times when I do things, I share things with my mom, and I hope that she will pick up on them. And actually, she's been doing some really cool work lately. It's been really cool to see. But, you know, she's doing that work, and that's really great. And I've done my fair share of prompting and pushing, and those things just occur, you know, around the same time. It's not one making the other happen.
Things compound.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, I feel like I have this drive for self and other improvement because of my parents, and it was created because I wanted my parents to be better, but it doesn't, even then I knew deep down, even though I was like not consciously thinking about it, I can't improve my parents. Like, they're just who they are. And also, I didn't have the capacity to improve any other people. I mean, ever, but like I didn't have the capacity to improve myself or show others what improvement looks like until much more recently. And you're like, 2013 was the beginning of my self-improvement really trajectory. And then like 2017, I started to actually have some cool benefits. But it wasn't really until like 2021 or two that I feel like I even had the, the proper 2022, really, the proper skills and abilities to say, like, okay, I've tried some things and I've found finally some successes. Yeah, definitely not since then trying to change or improve my parents much. So back to the schedule. So that was 10 a.m. it was just like, it was so concentrated, and it felt like a wonderfully long day. Like it didn't feel too long. It didn't feel drawn out, but it didn't feel rushed either. And it wasn't like I was losing time. In fact, I felt like I was appreciating time so much more than I had in a long time. So then we came, so 45 minutes of that, we came in for a sitting meditation, and it was just silence. And then we went back out for a walk at 11:15. We went back out for a walking meditation. I chose a different spot and was just walking back and forth and doing my inner monologue of mantras.
So yep. So we're sort of still on the same theme there.
Yeah.
There wasn't a different guidance.
Yes. Yeah. And he'd given another one that I really wish I could have remembered. It was a bit more kind of like Buddhist structured. It was something like, may I have everything I need. May others find peace. May, you know, that kind of thing. It was a bit more like kind of universal, and I really liked it. But yeah. Then he immediately went into the, I forgive you, may you forgive me, I forgive myself. And that was so easy to remember. And it just kind of pushed out the other one. And I was like, well, I guess I'm using that one. One of the biggest hurdles was not taking notes, not writing anything down, not saving anything. It was all just memory. And that was pretty hard for me. I've had memory issues short-term and long-term for a long time. And I knew that going in that I wasn't going to be taking notes, but so I was prepared for it, but it was also kind of like, man, I wish I could write some of this stuff down.
I remember that the first time I had my first full therapy session.
Ooh, yeah.
Of sort of thinking I had to, you know, I should be writing notes, and he was like, why do you?
That's my job.
Yeah. and also, you know, things will take care of themselves. Yes. And, you know, and one of the things that I did start to do, which it ties in a tiny bit to what we're talking about here, is so often in the world, and I think maybe you do this as well, moving through the world with some kind of headphones.
Oh, on, yeah.
Music or a podcast. Oh, yeah. Or whatever. And I really started to relish coming out of those sessions and just the walk to the bus stop and the drive, or the bus ride to where I'd get lunch and all that, to just have, you know, 45 minutes, an hour with the thoughts that had just occurred, you know, that had just sprung up, and the things that we talked about in that session, rather than pushing them down or risking, you know, pushing them out because you're getting some other stimulus.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think, you know, when you say you have short-term memory issues, I wonder if that's really true. Or if it's just a thing that we do that you know, we just push things around a bit.
Yeah. Well, I would say my short-term memory has improved noticeably since I purged the mold.
Yeah, it makes sense, I guess.
Which, that was, what a relief. Yeah, I think I've also seen an improvement with a more dedicated meditation practice. I think both of those have really improved, and I definitely have a better memory now than I've had most of my life. But yeah, I completely co-sign that after any type of therapy or inner work of just taking some time for silence and not immediately stimulating your eardrums. On the topic of things to remember, one of the things I did write down, like in my truck as soon as I got back, and we're like, okay, the retreat's over, you know, you can turn back on and get back out and all that kind of stuff. And the things that I wrote, this was all I could write down. This is all I remembered from his Dharma talks, but these were my favorite parts. So there was two equations: pain plus aversion equals suffering. Pain is not suffering, but pain with aversion to that pain is suffering. And then also, pleasure plus attachment equals suffering. Pleasure isn't suffering, but with attachment, grasping onto it, needing to have it, needing to have that pleasure that you've always had or have always wanted, or keeping a hold of it, having a certain restrictions on it, attachment, that's suffering. I really related to those. And then another one was craving is to needing as desire is to wanting. Somebody asked about addiction cravings. There was some talk about the Buddhist path and the refuge path leading to a reduction or elimination of cravings for, you know, whatever addictive substances or behaviors. And, you know, some of these people are like, I could really use that help now. I could really use that lack of craving. Like, how does that happen? When does that happen? How do we get that? And so a little bit of guidance of like, you can shift that, you know, you're thinking of it as a craving. And so then therefore that a craving would be a need. If you realize that that craving is actually just a desire and a want, you can want it and not partake, not have it, because it's not a need. But if you're thinking about it as a craving, if you're feeling it as a craving, you're going to need it. You're going to need it just as much as air or gravity.
There is also, I think, coupled with that, and I don't know if this is something that, that was gotten into, but my understanding with cravings, and this is something that was brought up in a session I was in yesterday, is those kinds of stress feelings. And I think it might just be certain substances, they last for a certain amount of time and then they subside. So it's something, I think for stress, the feelings of stress, if you don't keep thinking about the thought, the stress response goes away after 90 seconds. But what we so often do is we keep thinking the thought.
Yeah.
And so, there is another thing called something surfing.
Channel surfing?
No, you're being silly. Basically, the idea is you are surfing the craving, the feeling of that craving. So rather than feeling like you are, that it's on top of you, you ride it and you actively sort of ride it and you're present with it and you notice it. And then after, it's something like, it's a fairly small number of seconds for certain substances. Obviously, it differs.
Urge surfing?
Might well be urge surfing, yeah.
Yeah. It's a mental technique to manage urges and cravings.
And some of this might be a bit oversimplified for certain things, but like when you start to link that up as well with, I love that framing of it's not a need.
No.
And then it makes it more of a choice.
Yeah.
You are taking the choice to not give in to that, not even give in to act upon that craving.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I can't remember where I heard this, but very recently I heard somebody talking about how we way overuse the term need. It's like we need water. We need oxygen. We need gravity. We need food, sustenance, sunlight. We don't need coffee. We don't need alcohol or so many other chocolate. These are all ingestible things, but we don't need so many things that we say we do. And us telling ourselves over and over that we need them, you know, fucks with our mind a bit.
And then some of the things that we do need, we put in the category of want, like human connection or human contact, even skin on skin contact. We put that in the category of wanting, whereas it is actually something that we need.
Agreed. The last thing I remembered from what he wrote or what he spoke was something that I was actually already thinking, and it's not a super original thought at all, but this was something that I was thinking about with God mode, and even have it already in my notes from before. But he said, a book can never give you the answers. It's always within yourself. You have all the answers within you already. You know, you just need to uncover them and act and realize them and act on them. And realize the voices and compulsions in your head and your body, which ones are the ones that are your actual soul talking to you, or your actual being, the truth of the matter, versus
your essence,
versus like outside messages, things controlling you, your food gaslighting you, and that kind of thing. So then we have
that one feels harder to grasp, because I know where it's aiming at, I know where it's trying to get to, but it feels, because I think we need, and it's one of those weird things, like coaching is really about asking questions and not giving advice. So it's very much about you finding the answers. And so, yes, the answers are in there.
Yeah,
absolutely they are. But I don't know if we can always do it self-sufficiently. I think sometimes we need someone to ask the question that didn't occur to us to help us then find the answer that we knew was there. Do you know what I mean? It's
100%.
I think, yeah.
Yeah. And he's not saying don't read books.
Of course.
You know, he was saying, like, when I'm not on silent retreat, I read a book, I read a book for a half an hour or an hour before bed every night. But it's still being that it doesn't have the answer. It can't actually make the change within you.
Oh, that's a big one. Like, a book can't do the action. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I feel it too. So we did the lunch meditation. After that was a bit of rest. We got, so it was between 12 and 2:15 that we got to just kind of do our own kind of thing. And so we could do a walking meditation if we wanted to, or if we just wanted to take a nap or a sitting meditation or kind of whatever we wanted to do. I chose to do my typical yoga session. I have kind of crafted my own series of poses that I really enjoy. It feels like a kind of a full body experience, but not having many sun salutations, which is a lot of standing up and sitting down and standing up and sitting down, which is really hard for me with some of the medical conditions I have, POTS specifically, and it's a restriction of blood flow. And so when I stand up too quickly or too often, I lose a lot. I get kind of dizzy and lightheaded. So I've made my own routine. It's about 45 minutes long, and I just love it so much. I get into Pigeon, I get into Star Child and Bridge, and a bunch of really great stuff. It's so fun. Then we came in for a sitting meditation for 45 minutes, a walking meditation for 45 minutes, back to a sitting, and then this time had instructions and a Q&A again. Yeah, and then we just went back and forth between walking and sitting and walking and sitting until dinner, which was great. Then we had a sitting meditation with a Dharma talk, and this was like more like an hour long presentation of a thought. It was all improvised. It wasn't like reading a thing, but it was a much more thorough talk about the actual more about Buddhism and about the enlightened path, sort of, and a little bit how it relates to addiction, because that's what all brought us here. But otherwise, it was a bit more about the path, and that was really great. I enjoyed that a lot. And then at the end, it was like, it's dark now. After dinner, we were able to, there was enough time between 6 and 7 before the sitting meditation, we were like, watch the sunset over the hills. And it was fucking beautiful to just be really present with it for like a half an hour and just like, just waiting for it. And you're just watching the movement of it. Cause you can, when you, you know, you just look for a couple seconds at the sunset and it's like, it looks like it's still. It's just like a moment. It's great. It's beautiful. But when you're just sitting there for a while and you're watching and you can really just see it move, and that's really just something else. But yeah, then we had the Dharma talk, and then there was an option to do a walking meditation before going to sleep. I went out to my first walk, first little spot overlooking the river, and I was all alone. And This is where I really did the I forgive you, Mom. Step. I forgive you, Dad. Step. I forgive you, Jessica. Step. Meditation and step. Just feeling so alone at this point and in the dark under the stars. There wasn't a lot of light pollution. It was just really nice to be in the dark, in the moonlight, and
turn around.
The last guidance for that day is at 9 p.m. Continue practice or sleeping meditation. And the sleeping meditation would just be to follow your breath until you fall asleep. He's kind of a bit lax about the sleeping meditation. He's like, yeah, you know, you're just going to sleep. So like, just do what you need to
just go to sleep.
Just kind of go to sleep. Which is pretty funny. Yeah, in the morning it would be kind of the same kind of setup. We did a waking up meditation. You try to notice what your in breath or out breath when you wake up. And I didn't sleep too great. I think
that was my question.
I woke up, I was partnered with somebody who was snoring, which I don't think really kept me up too much, but it was just kind of, you know, there.
Is that something you were aware of being sensitive of?
No, I mean, no, I've been around snorers before, and it just isn't something that really, well, I am a lighter sleeper now than I used to be. I used to be a much heavier sleeper. Also, especially since I start wearing an Oura ring that tracks my sleep, I can analyze my sleep a lot more. I'm seeing like how many times I wake up, and I've been working on my sleep so much, like wearing my red light glasses and using candlelight at night and a bunch of other stuff that we've talked about in the past. And so my sleep has improved greatly. And so now when it's disrupted, I can feel it and sense it and understand it a lot better. It's way easier than when having a poor sleep schedule all the time. It's like, well, I don't really notice a difference in this and that. But I woke up quite a bit. I woke up one of the nights, I only got like about 5 hours of sleep. Honestly, I felt pretty rested. I felt pretty fine the whole day. It reminded me of this. I had this friend in high school who I didn't know too well, and we were in the same choir together. He knew meditation. I think he was of Middle Eastern descent, possibly Indian descent, in somewhere in that area. And it was definitely a part of his culture and upbringing in his family and stuff. And he would say that he only slept like 3 hours a night, and he did a lot of meditation, and he never seemed tired. He also did not seem like a liar. And I was always just like, kind of like, huh?
How do you do that?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
And now with doing more meditation and focusing on getting better sleep, like, you know, it's funny with all the guidance of like on Oura Ring and Huberman and all these different people that are talking about better sleep, they still push this 8 hour guideline of sleep. And I'm noticing that, man, when I'm getting good quality sleep, I don't need that many hours in bed. I don't need eight if I have a high quality five.
Yeah, it is only an average.
Sure.
And also, yeah, like it's. I imagine that so much of it has to be down to the amount of REM sleep, because that's really the deep shit.
Yeah, and also meditation. Like the more I meditate and the more I have a good centering practice of my day to day, the less sleep I feel like I need as well. Yeah, and then we had the sitting meditation and the breakfast, and then we had a full refuge recovery meeting at the end, which was great. So it was about 70 people. I thought it was going to be like 30 to 40, but it was combined. It was 70 people.
Wow.
So in a refuge recovery meeting at the, you know, the structure of a meeting is there is a 20-minute guided meditation read by somebody, one participant, one volunteer, and then a reading from the refuge recovery book, and then a sharing. And so, you know, it's tag pass. So you can be like, okay, hey, George, why don't you go? And, you know, after you finished, and then they would go, and then they would call on somebody else. And then at the end, like it would be volunteer. If you really wanted to say something, but you didn't get called, you'd say your piece. And you'd be talking about either how the meditation was for you or something that stood out to you in the reading of that day or something related to addiction or recovery and that kind of thing. And so we did an RR meeting at the end of the retreat, and it was a bit modified because there were so many people there. We went around and just said our first names and how long we had been doing refuge and or addiction recovery stuff. We did a 20-minute guided meditation, which was really great. And then we didn't read from the book, and instead we went around, all 70 of us, and we each got 1 minute, and we talked about what we got from our time this weekend on the silent retreat. And that was really nice. That was really cool to hear from everybody, just a fragment of their story and their reward and their process. And that was really great. The two things that I kind of shared, one was the revelation about my parents and my efforts to like try to improve people and that kind of thing. I was able to kind of truncate that into about 30 seconds somehow. And I also talked about being a table captain and I said, or not a table captain, but just the lunches in general. So, okay, the guidance for the food before going there was the practice that we participate in this noble silence type of retreat is that we just take what is offered to us. The intention with that being, don't be so picky. Don't be like, oh, I need this to be... I need unsalted butter, or I need, you know, this kind of thing. And, you know, like, I don't just take what's given to you, eat it, meditate on it, enjoy it. And, don't be fussy. For me, I was thinking like, because I am so focused on what I put in my mouth and, you know, I'm like, not allergic to sugar, but I'm like, you know, sugar is the enemy. It's a poison, you know, it has no nutritional value and that kind of thing. You know, like I'm like so focused on that and other things that are like good for me and bad for me. And these things are going to become me and they are the nutrients that my body is going to use, that kind of stuff. Like, I was like, I got this guidance, like just eat what's given to you. And I'm like, okay, I will follow this guidance. I will not freak out about what I'm getting. If I'm given a muffin that I know it has sugar in it or whatever, I'll just eat the muffin and it'll just be a meditation on it and all of that. I was like, great. I mean, I'm kind of excited because I get to have sugar because I still crave it a lot.
Sounds like you're human.
I still desire it, not crave it. So I'm like, okay, great. Okay, so they give me a plate of food. I'm just going to eat my plate of food. Wonderful. And then we get there and it's family style. It's all you can eat. Oh. And there's just plates of sticky buns and blueberry muffins and orange cake. And there was one dessert typically per meal, but like there was always a lot of extra. And the oatmeal bar, it only came out during a couple breakfasts, but it was like, it was there and it had, you know, the brown sugar and the cinnamon and the raisins and the, you know, all these things. I did my best. I only had...
Save space, Brendan, you can tell me.
I only had 2 to 3 desserts per meal.
Okay.
The blueberry muffin. Okay, so on one of the breakfasts had this blueberry muffin. Mm-hmm. God, it was so good. It was like a cupcake with no icing. It was so freaking yummy. And I was like, is this? And all of the food was really good. But yeah, like, did they really make this from scratch? Or is this just like a box? I can't even tell. It's so good. Mm-hmm. And I think I had 3 of those. The first dinner dessert was like this blueberry compote with like a little bit of oats on top of it. I'm like, this is great. Like, I, you know, starting out like, oh, this is the dessert they're offering, like the least sweet fruit with like a little bit of oats. Oh, I'm down. Oh, this is going to be great. And then the next morning it was like the blueberry muffin. And I'm like, oh, But yeah, so when I made my oatmeal, I didn't use the brown sugar. I didn't use the cinnamon, which is inflammatory, but I did use the dried cranberries, almonds, unsweetened coconut, and then I chopped up the bacon that they had served us and mixed that in, and damn, that was good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then when I think on the last meal, the last breakfast that they gave us, they had these sticky buns, which were just like these cinnamon roll things without icing. And I let my cinnamon ban go away and had at least 2 of those. I don't think I had 3. Maybe I had 3. It's fuzzy. I didn't go into all of this during my 1 minute share. But I said, it's complicated for a person coming to recovery who is a food or a sugar addict to be presented with an all-you-can-eat array when given the guidance to just take what is offered. And like, okay, well, all of this stuff is offered. I'm allowed to have as much as I want. It's not like there's a six pack of beer and a few lines of Coke and they say, just have one.
How is that received by the people in charge, as it were? Because that's, you know, that's feedback.
Yeah. Yeah. It was feedback. And I think it was, I mean, it seemed to have been taken well. I didn't really get any direct response or anything from that.
Yeah. No, sure.
But I think that was kind of like, yeah, well, you're here to meditate on that, you know?
Yeah. It's so interesting that the whole thing of abundance,
mm-hmm.
because when you said family style, immediately I went, oh, and I felt myself go inwards and oh no. And I know Americans love their family style and I just, oh no. Because it all feels so, for me, I mean, I had this a couple of days ago. I was at a meal and someone, and it wasn't like a tapas situation, but someone made it a tapas situation where they were like, let's just get one of every starter for the table. And I'm like, there's a number of reasons why I hate that.
Yeah.
One of them being I need clear boundaries, not because I want to take it all.
Yeah.
It's not because I want to take all of the food,
yep.
but it's, I need to know what I'm allowed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if there is so much abundance, if there is clearly more food than anyone can eat,
yep.
any reasonable person can eat,
yep.
that's great. I will probably take a sensible amount because I know the boundaries are clear and I'll be happy.
Yeah.
If I feel like, you know, there's that situation where you're hemmed in and it's yep. like, that makes me miserable. And yep. this is one of the things I've really realized. And it's not rational. You know what I mean? It's a completely irrational thing. But there is definitely an idea of abundance that is important. And again, like it's easy to see that as coming from a place of greed, and I don't think it is. It's
no.
like it's boundaries. It's like, yeah, I need to know what I'm allowed and what I'm not allowed.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I will always understep.
Yeah. And uncomfortably so.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
To the point where I'm like, I feel I'm so happy when I'm in an unfamiliar environment and I can meet my basic needs. That sounds like such a strange thing to say. But like yesterday, I was shattered after 3 days and half a day of travel. So for like 3.5 days, basically 4 days of being like on and being in unfamiliar spaces and navigating and doing people stuff and all this thing. And I, you know, I got to a point where I just wanted to be invisible for a bit and sit and get some food and all that stuff. And I had lovely interaction with the person who served me because it was a pub without a station, pub by the station, train station with outside seating. And I sat down, got my table number, figured out what I wanted to have, went in. And she was like, we don't serve that now because that's only for lunch. Okay, no worries. I'll take a menu, sit down again. And she said, I'll come out to you and take your order. Great. So she comes out, takes my order, goes back in, food comes, I'm eating away. And at some point I'm like, I've got to pay for this at some point. And then she comes out and she's like, I'm really sorry. My boss is at me. Like, we have this policy we're supposed to. And she was like mm-hmm. charming and apologetic. And I'm sat there going, it's completely fine. Like, you don't know me from Adam. You don't know. I could just sit and walk, you know, yeah. eat and dash. Like, yeah, absolutely, you know. And it was a lovely interaction. Mm-hmm. It was just, of course, no worries. And it was one of those where you kind of get the feeling, I bet, like, she went back into the manager and said, he was lovely about it. You know, it's one of those where you're like, mm-hmm. I kind of know how I think that went.
Yeah.
So I did that, and then I really needed a wee, and I was like, I had my big suitcase, and I had my backpack, and the pub was busy. I didn't want to navigate that. I went into the train station. All the toilets were out of use, and so they've got these temporary toilets. And like, in the end, like, I sorted that, you know, like, food, belly full,
yeah.
had a nice drink, mm-hmm. had a wee, and like, especially in an unfamiliar environment where I'm out, I'm just like, there you go, like. But we're in those moments where there's a basic need,
yeah.
you know, something like you know, like food or like being thirsty or something like that, it really bothers me when I can't meet that, you know, that basic need. And so I think even if it's not really a need, I don't need, I will, I can go days without eating. It's fine. Yes. You know what I mean? Yeah. Of course it's not, but it's, you know, that's why I said it's irrational. But, you know, it's really interesting that there is something like abundance, generosity, all that kind of stuff is so different from how that was initially presented with, you know, you will get what's, you will take what's given. Mm-hmm. I like the spirit of that though, because what it made me think about was what I understand to be a much more Eastern philosophy of think less about yourself and more about the collective.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than focusing, well, I'm a gluten intolerant vegan who only eats things on a like, yeah, that feels like it comes from a very Western individualistic place.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to certain people, but like, if you actually have a genuine thing where you're like, you're really going to blow up because you eat a particular thing, that's fine. But don't use it as a, like substitute for a personality. Like, don't make this part of your identity, or don't be that one person who's like, no, I've got to hold the group up because I need my gluten-free vegan. It's like, you don't, you just need a different personality.
Yeah.
Sorry. It's one of those things where it's
I get it.
It feels like a hedge against that to, and so, like, not everybody's going to be entirely happy, and some people might be a bit uncomfortable. And obviously, if there's a real thing where you're like, I'm deathly allergic to peanuts, don't give me shit with peanuts in, of course.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't become about the collective.
No.
But I like that tip towards that way of thinking of, like, this is all about the, which feels very in keeping with the Enneagram 9, to be honest, of just, like,
for sure,
harmony and let's get along.
Yep. Yeah, and an aspect of the lesson I took from that guidance is, you know, my typical eating pattern is to eat one meal a day. And
yeah, of course.
With being told, you know, you just eat what's given to you, I'm like, okay, well, intermittent fasting is out the window for this trip, and I'm really happy about it. Like, I'm excited to go through the experience of three meals a day again. Like, that's interesting. Wow. An archaic tradition. Like, I'm just like, well, let's try this out. See what these people do. To your point about the appetizers, just briefly, like I don't typically order appetizers just because I usually think they're kind of too expensive for what they are often. And I'm a bit frugal. But when somebody else orders them for the table or whatever, I love it. It's great. But man, the anxiety of when there is one too few or one too many, when it's just like, just barely, it's like, oh, I would love to have that extra taquito, but I'm not going to be the one that goes and just grabs it when there's four of us and five taquitos and like, you know, I'm hungry. I just got appetized. Like I'm hungry now. So I want that extra one. And, or when there's one too few and it's like, okay, let's cut them all into two thirds so we can like somebody gets a third of each piece.
It's funny how shaming, like, What's the problem in saying I'm hungry and I want it? Like, I would never dream of saying that.
I know. Same.
Because there's so many stories, and you know, this is why both of us have stuff around food, I guess.
Yep.
You know, most people are just like, it's food, you eat it or you don't.
I know.
Or, you can get more if you're hungry later. Whereas for us,
I wonder
it's
what
like,
the problems they have.
Ah, you know, like, it's a real problem. I'm hungry and I want it. It's like, that's okay. Like, there is food. There is food later if you want food later. And I think, you know, maybe I didn't grow up in a household where food was not abundant, but I think I grew up in a household where I attached meaning to food in a big way, and like special occasions and treats. And it was a way of showing love, not because love wasn't shown in other ways, but it was just another way. And like, it you know, had all this meaning. Ooh, a little bit of, nom, nom, nom. You know, and when you build up those things, you see those patterns, and then you don't receive that thing. You're like, oh no, what did I do? You know, what did I do wrong? I didn't get, we didn't get chips on the way home. Is that something I did wrong or whatever? Mm-hmm. And so when you're in a social food situation, there is just so much stuff, and it would be wonderful if we could all just figure out like what is the best way to do this, and tapas ain't it. Like, small plates ain't it. Unless, you know, it's really clear. I mean, I so going to the my business hippie thing, it's not been too bad. It's like the way they do it is like lots of dishes of things, mm-hmm. and the tables are sort of divided up a little bit, and so the caterers will come out and you've got like three or four different dishes of things that you can then put on your plate, and so people will pass things around, and that's okay, and you can kind of look at what's there and, you know, get a spoon and dollop out what looks like a reasonable portion for you, and that's okay. But it's still just like, but I want more of that thing over there. I want less of this thing over here. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, yeah. It's food and social. And then like, and then for me, like you add in this, the thing of sometimes I don't know what a thing is. Like you put that in front of me. I don't know what it is. I don't know where. And I was saying this to patron saint of the podcast, Anna.
Hi, Anna.
Hi, Anna. Ring the bell. Take a drink. Some items are not clearly, like, I don't know what a unit of this is.
Mm-hmm.
What is one of these things?
Because can I have one, please? What is that?
I don't know, because, like, sometimes you pick up this is just my situation. And
what
you,
really is one sticky bun? Like, really? Because they're all kind of, like, twisted into each other and, like, next to, like, how do you clearly define, I don't.
How do we delineate? it's just, you know, it's madness. You take something like a mini burger or a sandwich. Sometimes you get these sandwiches and it's like, it's three pieces of bread. And so what happens is you think it's two pieces of bread. So you take the thing and then it's like, there's now half of a sandwich and someone's looking at you going, what did you just leave half that sandwich? Or you do the criminal thing of accidentally taking a sandwich and a half. And then you've got the dilemma of, if I put it back, there are people who are really... And I got, like, I was thinking about this yesterday, like, one of the reasons it popped up in my head is I didn't get shamed, but I experienced a great degree of shame.
Sure.
When I was at, I don't know, 10, and I was at my friend's house, and we were good friends, best friends. He had dyspraxia, which is like almost like a very mild form of cerebral palsy, which just effectively, it's what we would have called kids in the 70s clumsy, essentially, kind of.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, coordination is not always easy.
Yeah.
And I'm visually impaired. And so we're all cool, all fine.
Yeah.
But obviously he's been brought up in a household. They're quite, I'd say, middle class-ish. Mm-hmm. And there are some degrees of airs and graces and politeness and that kind of stuff. And so I reach out for something and I accidentally touch another thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he, being a child, because we're both children, and seeing that a transgression has occurred, goes, he touched that thing. His mum is mortified,
mm-hmm.
because she has understood what's happened,
uh-huh.
and that I didn't intentionally, like, snaffle a whole, like, I just, trying to figure the situation out with my hand.
Yeah.
And she sends him out of the room for, like, the rest of the meal. And he doesn't really know what he did wrong.
Yeah.
And he protests. He's like, what? And she's, no, go away. And they're like, I know what's happened.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, what is even my place to say, you know? And so it's like, I didn't get shamed, but he absolutely got shamed, but it was because of a thing I did.
Right. Oh, that's unfortunate.
This is why things get complicated around food.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, there's definitely that in my head, mm-hmm. of, like, you cannot put your fingers on something that you do not intend to eat, because... you know, that's a big trans, you know, and it's like, I fucking hate it all. I hate it all.
Yeah.
It makes me so upset. It makes me so grumpy. It makes me feel so alienated.
For sure.
Because it's just a simple thing that we do as a society. It's, you know, breaking bread. Mm-hmm. It's all lovely, mm-hmm. and it's communal, and we take and then we give, and it's all, and I fucking hate all of it because I do not know what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah. We should just wrap everything in plastic, individual.
I tell you what, actually, I went to an event a couple of years ago, about 18 months ago now, and they just had little paper lunch boxes, like, you know, little lunch bags.
Yes.
Individual. And everybody had a lunch bag.
No, that's perfect.
Just do that all the
exactly.
time. Little sandwich in there, little, you know, just there you go, just
offered.
Take a lunch bag. It just works so
it
well.
Does.
And, you know, yes, there was a stand of cakes and all sorts of other things, and you could play that game. And that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, for the actual lunch, for the things that you need to sustain you throughout the day, the basic needs are taken care of, and you don't have to fend for yourself or figure it out.
I just want my lunch.
Don't make me figure it out, Brendan.
Yeah, I know. So yeah, you mentioned some travels. What have you been up to this week?
I've been to the seat of learning, or one of the two major seats of learning in England. I've been to Cambridge.
Ooh.
Yes. It is wall-to-wall doctors and bicycles, essentially. if they're not doctors, they're med students. And I was there doing some facilitation and a few other bits and getting some training as well.
Ooh.
Picked up a new sort of coachy type methodology.
Ooh.
Or a way of asking coaching questions, which is nice.
That's very cool.
And was on stage briefly interviewing someone who was putting on a conference about it. So they have a podcast, and they organized a one-day convention around the podcast.
Neat.
Which was brilliant. Yeah, I got to interview the host of the podcast because I helped make the podcast.
Nice.
Yeah, got the crowd singing, did some stupid things, played some, you know, had a bit of fun, was, you know, a little bit gently naughty, gently transgressive, which is sort of my way.
Mm-hmm.
Still being very safe, but also, you know, having fun.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to have gone down very well. So it was 3 days of being on and navigating and, you know, unfamiliar situations and also being professional and all these different things. And so there was a, you know, could be a kind of a networky component to the Wednesday day, the convention of, you know, at least go around and shake some hands and talk to people and nightmare. There's a reason we've been diving a lot into the Enneagram as well. There's a reason I'm an SX, which is a one-to-one type.
Yeah.
One-to-one conversations I do pretty well in and enjoy those.
I can see that.
And once I'm kind of in a conversation, I'm fine. It's just starting them really just going. It is alien to me. It is completely alien how you see another human being. And I mean, when I go to these things, it's like no one is unoccupied. Everybody's already talking to someone else. I don't know how it, and I've presented on this topic. I've recorded a podcast episode on this topic, and I've come up with great solutions.
Uh-huh.
I still don't know what the hell to do.
Yeah.
Anyway, and so that all, you know, that all takes a lot of energy. But I was doing okay, sort of managing that kind of stuff. One of the things I'd realized as I, you know, because as I said, there was this sort of networky element to the thing that is very difficult. But if you give me a job, like a task, I actually found like properly like a little elf or a little one of the seven dwarves. I was like happily humming to myself when I had a little job to do. And I was like, and I was like right now in this moment, you know, I've been given a task, set me to a task in a bunch of people and I'm absolutely fine. And it's like, That's what works for me. And I think I perhaps have to figure out ways that I can set myself about a task, you know, because it could be anything. It could be take a tray of canapes around. I've never had to take a tray of canapes around, but I feel like that's a task and I could complete that task. Mm-hmm. And I could easily go up to people and say, would you like a finger of fudge? Or I don't know why I said finger of fudge, but you know, would you like an oyster thing, you know, a little mini burger. And, you know, I think the challenge there is you're supposed to sort of remain kind of invisible and not get into conversations with people. You know, that kind of thing, or like, you know, go around, make sure people have got whatever they need. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing feels a lot easier. Yeah. And I can do that with people because I'm not actually, this is one of the things that like I have to remind myself, like I'm not bad at people. There's just that without a purpose,
right,
without a task.
Yep.
It's really tricky. And without the task being evident to both parties, like I think it can't just be evident to me.
Yeah.
It's got to be somehow evident to both parties.
Yeah. That's exactly.
Sounds like that makes sense.
That's exactly why I volunteered to be a table captain.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a cool trip.
Yeah. It was great. And lovely to meet people that, for the most part, I've only seen in Zoom boxes, and just to be reminded, it's always nice to be reminded that one is charming. I felt charming. I felt like I'd done some charm.
Amazing.
And that always feels good.
It does feel good. It does feel good.
But it's tiring. It is tiring. Today I am tired, but I'm going to go out and I'm going to see some comedy tonight.
Yay. Get your scallop.
I'm probably going to have, because that is a Wednesday dinner.
Oh, is that a Wednesday? Okay.
But I probably will have something that includes a scallop with it.
Yeah. Nice.
Because I won't have eaten, so I'll have to eat late. I say have to. I will choose to.
Nice.
Because I'm a naughty boy. No, I not am going to indulge my pleasure center. Yes. For a bit. And
get that dopamine.
That should be a little bit of dopamine and salt.
Yum.
Yum. And sort of, yes, gently recharge. And then tomorrow I'm going to be talking about Korean rom-com TV shows.
Ooh.
For the next, I don't know if it'll be episode one, but for the next batch of episodes for List Envy.
Sweet. Sweet. I'm excited to listen.
That is now happening.
Awesome. You got like a good lineup of people like set up?
Or? Yeah. I've got a nice, got a nice sort of lineup of topics.
Nice.
Which, I mean, I'm recording three this weekend, which is great.
Awesome.
Because I want to go out of the traps. Let's have a look. So we've got Korean TV rom-coms, top five stand-ups that you must see live.
Ooh.
Top five haunted locations, top five Simpsons characters, and top five 80s sitcoms. Got more. There's quite a lot, actually, that I've got scheduled over the next few days, in fact. So,
very nice.
It is going to be pretty great.
I love that.
I haven't built a website for it. I want to.
Good job.
I know. I want to, but it's not what I should do.
Yeah.
And I looked like, oh, I'll tell you what, mate. I mean, this is proper inside the weeds, but I was looking at the show notes for all of the episodes. Uh-huh. I actually got this comment from a reviewer because I was do you remember the Bellow Collective?
Yeah. Yeah, they were great.
Back in the day, yeah. Took themselves a bit too seriously on the woke front, I think. But well-meaning people, very much.
Yes.
And I got a nice review from one of them as a perk of being a Patreon subscriber. And I think the comment was like, these show notes are really detailed, maybe a bit too much. Because like, I was thinking about the website and all the stuff. And it's like, I've really, really pared them down now because it's the more and more I realize, like, if people even do notice them,
right.
Like, they really want them short and just tell me the things I need to know.
Yeah.
And so
overview and links and maybe chapters.
That's so what's lovely is again, as we were talking about like last week or the week before with Transistor, like that's pretty much what I'm doing is intro, list of chapters, and then where you can find the guest. Because mm-hmm. that's really all. That's and if there's links specifically to other things, then that's fine. But like people, they want to be entertained. They don't want to be hunting and pecking around their phone for stuff. And like, mm-hmm. this is not aimed at people who are like, this is not the accidental tech podcast or whatever, where people are going specifically to the Overcast application and swiping to the show notes. You know, it's just like, people don't even know these things exist. So
yeah,
chill out about it.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be fun to do the first iteration of that tomorrow and see how it goes with my, surprise quiz that I drop on my guest.
I love that. I'm so excited. It was great talking to you, mate.
Yeah, you too,
great
dude.
Catching up.
What a pleasure.
Likewise, man. And if you ever wanted to try a silent retreat, this is now something that I recommend. I think that from what I've seen of the people attending, it seemed pretty universally, like a universal type of a range of people that enjoyed it, and that primarily everybody enjoyed it. There wasn't anybody that was like, this really, there was one person out of the 70 that was kind of like, yeah, this really wasn't for me.
That's not a bad batting average.
No, I don't think so. I think that's pretty cool. I think you're really cool.
I think you're really cool.
Thank you. As always, correct me if I'm wrong.
The button. There it is.
We'll We'll find ways to fill the empty, far from all the hysteria. I don't care if we suddenly find ourselves in Siberia. Siberia. We'll leave Portlandia for Siberia. Oh, hey, buddy.
How was the silent retreat?
Oh, my God, dude. I didn't get enough singing time, so I had to get that out right now.